Good morning. This is Susan at the Talking Information Center. It is Wednesday, February 18th. I am reading the Taunton Daily Gazette. Freedman Middle School to get solar panels. Move will save Taunton thousands of dollars by Emma Rindlisbacher. Solar panels will be coming to the roof of the Benjamin A. Freedman Middle School in Taunton a year after solar panels were also installed on the roof of the Chamberlain Elementary School. The project team is targeting substantial completion for Freedman by Monday, March 30th, 2026, a letter from the superintendent of schools, John Cabral, said regarding the Freedman solar panel project. Cabral's letter said, a roof replacement project for the Freedman School had been completed, which paves the way for the solar panels to be installed by March. Matthew Parent, a solar consultant who works for the city of Taunton, said the Chamberlain solar project was successful, and because electricity costs have gone up quite a bit, solar projects are a win-win for municipalities looking to reduce energy costs and gain revenue by selling solar power to the electric grid. Here's what we know about the project to add solar panels to the Freedman School roof and why solar panels can help cities and towns manage cost and gain revenue. Timeline. A roof replacement project for Freedman Middle School has been fully completed, Superintendent Cabral wrote in a letter to the Taunton School Committee. He said work on the roof started in June 2025. Cabral said a contractor would begin installing solar panels on the now-replaced Freedman School roof in February. He said the goal for the project is to reach substantial completion by March. How large will the project be? According to a poster at the Wednesday, February 4th Taunton School Committee meeting, 274 solar panels will be installed on the roof. The cost of the solar panel project will be approximately $480,000, solar consultant Matthew Parent said. That cost does not include the cost of replacing the roof. The project will generate energy savings of approximately $27,720 a year, Parent said. The project will also earn the city renewable energy certifications that are valued at approximately $7,000 a year, and the project will earn the city $144,000 in federal tax credits, he added. Taunton Chief Financial Officer Patrick Dello Russo said the city is not borrowing money to pay for the solar project. Rather, the city is funding the program through its yearly capital improvement plan. He said the project would break even after 9 years, after which the project would generate revenue, and that the project has a life expectancy of at least 20 to 25 years. Why municipalities are installing solar panels. Parent, the city's solar consultant, described the benefits of solar panels in an interview with the Gazette. A solar panel is essentially made up of silicon, glass, and metal, and then it is connected by wire, so no moving parts whatsoever, he said. The warranty on solar panels is 25 years, and they only degrade about 10%, 12% over that time. That's a pretty extraordinary thing. When you sell your energy, whether it's to the grid, such as Eversource, it's consistent revenue that really doesn't change over 20 to 30 years, he said. He said there are safety measures in solar systems and that the systems generally do not require a lot of maintenance. There are safety measures already in place. One's called a rapid shutdown. In case there's any surge in voltage, that automatically shuts down. And there's also an arc fault detector in solar projects. In case there's any surge in voltage, the system automatically shuts down. So there's quite a few safety measures put in place to make sure nothing happens, he said. A drawback of solar panels is that they are dependent on sunny weather. The parent advocated for using a mix of different energy sources to keep prices down. Obviously, places like Florida, where it's summer most of the year, would be different from Massachusetts. Those calculations are already taken into consideration when doing our analysis of what production you'll get over the year, he said. And you're not going to get 365 days of sunshine. You're going to get, up here in Massachusetts, closer to 300 because of rain, snow, sleet, and whatnot. It's the future of energy, not just renewable energy, to be able to have a portfolio of solar, photovoltaic, solar thermal, wind, geothermal, gas, and oil, he said, as we have a good mixture that will keep prices down. Taunton Area Towns Struggle to Pay for Schools by Emma Rindlisbacher. Many people are talking about the need for the state to provide more education funding, but not everyone is talking about how the state would pay for it. Massachusetts Association of School Superintendents Executive Director Mary Bork told the Gazette the state's formula to distribute education funding is not working because costs are now exceeding any amount of money that is in the formula. She said the schools are facing increasing costs due to inflation and other factors, and that her association would be advocating for increases in most of the areas of the governor's budget. In a 2024 analysis, the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center said state education aid for local school districts, known as Chapter 70 funding, did not increase proportionately with inflation in the prior school year. The center said that adjusting state education funding for inflation would require $465 million in additional funding annually. Finding that additional money is easier said than done. When asked if, are you talking about more revenue for these schools? Bork said, I believe we are, yeah. However, when asked, would that come from increased taxes or where would that come from? Bork said that, I'm not saying that at all. I think you're asking for me to do definitive answers when I have more questions for our policymakers, she said. We need to get another Foundation Budget Reform Commission and start putting those questions on the table. Here's what we know about the state of education funding in Massachusetts and how gateway cities like Taunton have been able to avoid some of the budget challenges facing many other school districts. How 2019 law affects Taunton and other school districts. School districts outside of Taunton, such as Bridgewater, Raynham, Berkeley, Dighton, Rehoboth, and Middleborough, have all laid off teachers or are staring down that prospect. Bridgewater-Raynham attempted to pass two override votes to raise taxes in order to generate funding for schools, but voters rejected the tax increases in 2025. This year, the town of Berkeley is considering an override vote to raise taxes as well. Taunton Public Schools, meanwhile, have avoided layoffs and override votes that have plagued nearby districts. Taunton has also seen substantial increases in the amount of aid it receives from the state. The district's Chapter 70 funding from the state increased by $10.4 million this year, from $95 million in the 2024-25 school year, raised to $105.4 million in the current 25-26 school year. For the next school year, Taunton is projected to receive an extra $4.2 million in Chapter 70 aid under the governor's proposed budget. One reason why Taunton has seen funding increases from the state is because of a 2019 law called the Student Opportunity Act, Taunton Superintendent of Schools John Cabral told the Gazette. We've been really blessed as a school system and as a city. We really benefited from the Student Opportunity Act, given the amount of funding we received over the last 7 years, he said. The Student Opportunity Act was a real game changer for communities like Taunton and other urban centers that address the rising costs in special education, the rising costs in healthcare, he said. The Student Opportunity Act was created to address funding inequities by allocating more state funding to school districts that have students that require higher levels of services. Prior to the Student Opportunity Act, we identified that our urban districts in particular were being disproportionately underfunded because they had disproportionately higher concentrations of students needing extra support, Bork said. Urban districts had a higher concentration, and still do, of children in poverty, of English language learners, and special education students, she said. Anthony Clough, a policy analyst for the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center, said the Student Opportunity Act is a 7-year commitment that slowly raises the amount of funding that districts who have more students with higher levels of needs receive. He said that after the next school year, the Student Opportunity Act will be fully implemented and that the overall ratio of funding different districts receive would not change further. Cabral said that he will always advocate that funding at the state level should always be proportional to the makeup and the demographics of a community, especially urban communities such as Taunton, Fall River, New Bedford, and Brockton. I believe the Massachusetts funding formula is one of the better funding formulas in the country, he said. But I do worry at the federal level and at the local level, it could be numerous matters that funding for communities like us could be impacted, and that would impact the level of services we're able to provide our students. Why hasn't state education aid kept up with inflation? The reason why Chapter 70 has not fully addressed inflation, Clough said, is that the state caps the inflation adjustment at 4.5% when actual costs have gone up a lot more than that. Proposition 2.5 limits how much cities and towns can increase taxes to pay for education. Increasing state education funding to take into account increased costs would presumably require increased revenue or cuts to other areas of the state budget or both. In Massachusetts, the cost of funding education is shared between the state and the local cities and towns, which fund their portion largely through property taxes. When voters have had the opportunity to boost local school funding through Proposition 2.5 overrides that would increase their property taxes, voters in Massachusetts towns have often said no. In Bridgewater and Raynham, the school district put forth a budget in 2025 that required voters approve overrides in both towns, and both towns shot them down. Subsequently, class sizes increased in the middle schools and the high school, and students say they are spending more time in study hall and less time in classrooms because extracurricular classes were cut. The state government might have an easier time raising taxes compared to cities and towns because the state is not bound by Proposition 2.5, which requires cities and towns in Massachusetts get voter approval to raise the total amount they collect in property taxes by more than 2.5% a year, plus an allowance for new construction. A spokesperson for Governor Mara Healey said in a statement, Governor Healey wants every student to get the high-quality education they deserve, no matter where they live. That's why she's fully funded the Student Opportunity Act every year, while also proposing significant increases in rural school, regional transportation, special education, and per-pupil aid. This is in addition to new investments in essential programs like early literacy tutoring and early college. We will continue working closely with municipalities and school districts to address their needs and support our hardworking educators. Chapter 70 funding continues to fail small districts. Berkeley Public Schools Superintendent Melissa Ryan, whose district underwent layoffs and is facing a potential 6% cut if an override vote doesn't pass, harshly criticized state education funding in an email to the Gazette. The town of Berkeley has a population of approximately 7,000 people, while the city of Taunton has a population of approximately 62,000. Chapter 70 funding continues to fail small districts like Berkeley by providing the appearance of stability without addressing the real cost of educating students, Ryan said. In the governor's budget, the minimum per pupil increase was reduced from $150 to $75, resulting in Berkeley receiving an increase of $44,900, which does not come close to covering rising fixed costs such as special education tuition, transportation, utilities, and contractual obligations, she said. It places us in a budget deficit before we even begin planning. While 49 districts will receive larger per pupil increases, 270 districts remain inadequately funded, she said, of the current conditions of funding. When one district receives a $19 million increase, while another faces $550,000 in reductions and the loss of 10 to 15 educators, it is clear the funding system is inequitable. The state has failed to move forward with a long-discussed commission to review and modernize the Chapter 70 formula, she said. The town of Berkeley is calling on the governor and state legislators to do the right thing by adequately funding school districts through a meaningful and equitable minimum per pupil rate. Delivering bags of love. Students, families team up to surprise Raynham housing residents by Beth McDermott. Children and families at the Children's Development Center recently took part in Bags of Love, a community service project. Participants gathered on February 7th to assemble 100 gift bags, according to a community announcement. The bags included snacks, bagels, pastries, candy, and pretzels, as well as homemade Valentine's Day cards created by the children and staff at the center. After filling the bags, the group distributed them to the Raynham Housing Authority residents by placing them on their doors, according to the announcement. The event provided an opportunity for children to learn about giving back. Some seniors living at the Housing Authority may not have regular visitors, and the project aimed to brighten their day, according to the announcement. One of the organizers, Carol Misor, has a long history of community involvement. As a former Girl Scout leader, Misor initially started the Bags of Love project with her daughter's Girl Scout troops. Now she continues the tradition with her granddaughter, Carly Hunter, and Girl Scout troop number 780845. Troop leader Tristan Jolly played a significant role in coordinating the event. Jolly also invited 8th grade boys seeking volunteer hours for the National Honor Society to participate, allowing them to contribute to the project, according to the announcement. The success of the Bags of Love event was made possible by the support of local businesses and organizations. Panera Bread, Dunkin' Donuts, and Shaw's provided donations, while families from the First Congregational Church of Raynham baked items for the bags. The Raynham Housing Authority facilitated the project by allowing the event to take place at its community center. The collaborative effort showcased how community members can come together to make a positive impact. Girl Scout cookie donations are helping Taunton this season by Beth McDermott. The Girl Scouts of Eastern Massachusetts delivered 1,200 packages of donated cookies to 3 nonprofit organizations, including the South Coast LGBTQ Network in Taunton. The donation is part of the organization's Cookies for a Cause initiative, according to a community announcement. Customers can purchase cookies and designate them to be donated to local organizations. In addition to the South Coast LGBTQ Network, Operation Troop Support in Danvers and Project Just Because in Hopkinton received cookies. The South Coast LGBTQ Network is dedicated to supporting the community in the South Coast region. Operation Troop Support assists deployed troops and their families, while Project Just Because helps struggling families in need. The cookie donations can be made through the end of the Girl Scouts cookie season, which runs through March 6, according to the announcement. Those interested in purchasing cookies for themselves or to donate can visit gsema.org/cookies to find a cookie booth or purchase from a troop's online cookie shop. Curling Scandal Isn't a Good Look for Canada by Nancy Armour through the USA Today Network. Cortina d'Ampezzo, Italy. Maybe we've gotten the Canadians all wrong. They seem to have the market cornered on niceness, the type of folks who always say hello and never have a bad word to say about anyone or anything. Certainly not the type to cause a ruckus or gasp cheat. And yet, for the second Olympics in a row, Canada is facing accusations that it's playing fast and loose with the rules to get an edge. Last time it was soccer, when the Canadian women's team was caught using drones to spy on opponents at the 2024 Paris Olympics. At the 2026 Milano Cortina Olympics, it's curling. Canada's men's team was called out not once but twice over the weekend for double touching, which can be either touching the stone after its release or touching the granite at any point. Then Canada's women were accused of a similar offense. Obviously, it's frustrating to have that happen, said Canada skip Rachel Homan, who had a stone removed from the ice for a double touch violation during a match against Sweden on February 14th. But we're trying to stick together as a team, and we're supporting the guys, and they're doing the same for us, Homan said. There's zero intention. It kind of got blown up for no reason. That is probably true. The Canadian curlers are accused of trying to manipulate their stone's trajectory, not carrying them down the ice and depositing them in the house, the bullseye that is the curler's goal. Plus, a curling stone weighs between 38 and 44 pounds, and there's 21 feet of ice between the hog line and the house. Giving the handle an extra tap or even touching the granite isn't going to be what gets Canada on the podium. But it's the combination of a cheating scandal in curling, which is always going to be fodder for the sport, not a sport debate, and the nicest people on earth being at the center of it that has turned it into the cause celeb at these games. There's always something blowing up at the Olympics, right? This year it's this, sweeper Emma Miskew said after Canada beat China on February 16th. In the tournament at the Olympics. It's all good. We'll get through it, Miskew said. I think it'll die down eventually. Yes, but what about the damage done to Canada's image as the country nobody can hate? Canadians are the human equivalent of Disneyland. The next time they're accused of being obnoxious or braggarts, it will be the first. They're easygoing and fun. Being around them is an immediate mood boost. They're like Australians, only with moose and maple syrup instead of koalas and kangaroos. Now the world, especially people not paying close attention, are going to think Canada is just as corrupt as everybody else, that they'll cut corners and throw people under the bus if it benefits them. The Canadians don't see it that way, of course. They believe they're the wronged party. We've played the game at a high level long enough where we weren't looking for infractions. We just trust that the people around us aren't trying to cheat, said Canada's Mark Kennedy, who was called out for double-touching by Sweden's Oscar Eriksson to start this whole mess. There might be small infractions here and there, but most of the time you shrug it off. You've got so much respect for the players that you're playing against, Kennedy said on Monday. So this whole trying to catch people in the act of an infraction to win a medal, it sucks. It's unfortunate, but it is what it is. Except there's video of the infractions, and while the Canadians might say they're inadvertent, it was a similar story initially in Paris. The women's coaching staff initially denied involvement or knowledge of the drone scheme, only for an investigation to reveal that it was a long-standing operation and the coaches had full knowledge and involvement in it. Maybe this time is different. Maybe the double-touch accusations are nothing but a misunderstanding. But when a country has cheating scandals in back-to-back Olympics, it starts to look like a pattern. And once trust is broken, the cloud of suspicion is almost impossible to clear, even if you're Canadian. Some Dems using scripture in campaign to voters. Christians have long gravitated to the GOP by Helen Koster and Joseph Axe via Reuters. Sarah Trone Garriott, an Iowa state senator and Lutheran minister, has never shied away from putting faith at the center of her political campaigns. This year, she is among an unusually high number of Democrats running for Congress who are infusing their campaigns with explicit appeals to religious doctrine, an effort national Democrats hope will peel away some Christian voters from the Republicans in November's midterm elections. Christian voters have long gravitated to the Republican Party, but some experts say President Donald Trump's second-term policies, particularly his crackdown on illegal immigration, could provide an opening for the Democrats. In some cases, the Democrats are themselves members of the clergy or are studying to join it, including Trone Garriott. Alaska congressional candidate Matt Schultz, a Presbyterian pastor, and Texas Senate candidate James Tallarico, a Presbyterian seminarian. More than a dozen faith leaders are running as Democrats for federal and state offices this year, far more than in previous cycles, according to Doug Padgett, a pastor who runs Vote Common Good, a progressive Christian political group. It is really important that people of faith speak to issues in the public realm, because faith is about how we live together, Garriott told Reuters. So is politics. Unlike many previous faith leaders who have run as Democrats, including Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock, this year's candidates don't come from the black church community that has historically been part of the Democratic base. They are trying to buck a persistent trend. The last white clergy member to serve as a Democrat in Congress appears to have been U.S. Representative Bob Edgar, who left office 4 decades ago. When you say that a candidate is religious, most voters then assume that they're Republican, that they're pretty conservative, said David Campbell, a political science professor at the University of Notre Dame. What you're seeing now is a small group of Democrats who are using religious language to speak about issues on the left. The approach comes with risks. In 2024, Trump won 83% of white evangelical voters, the highest on record, while earning support from the majority of both mainline Protestants and Catholics, according to an analysis by Ryan Burge, a professor at the Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University. Meanwhile, the Democratic base has become increasingly secular. 40% of people who prefer the Democratic Party identified as religiously unaffiliated in a 2023 large-scale survey by the Pew Research Center, more than double the share from 2007. If you're a Democratic candidate, you actually have a pretty tricky road to navigate because on the one hand, you do have a very secular base, people who are not very comfortable with religion, Campbell said. But on the other hand, there are a lot of moderate voters out there who are up for grabs, who are very comfortable with religious language. Schultz, who is challenging incumbent Republican U.S. Rep. Nick Begich in Alaska, said he is not concerned about people turning off non-religious voters. People have a more sophisticated view of religion than we often give them credit for, said Schultz. Mike Marinella, a spokesman for the Republican Party's National House campaign, dismissed the notion that candidates like Garriott and Schultz can threaten Republicans' popularity with Christian voters. Republicans have dominated with faith-based voters cycle after cycle because we're delivering on common sense, while Democrats are ramming through their radical liberal wish lists that are completely out of step with their own faith, he said. Iowa gubernatorial candidate Bob Sand, the state auditor and a practicing Lutheran, said a big reason he became a Democrat was that the Christian faith is all about looking out for the little guy. I can't tell you that I think it's a winning strategy, Sand said. I can tell you that I can't do this without talking about it. Sand is among the candidates, including Garriott, Schultz, and Tallarico, who are tying their faith to their support for one of the trickiest religious issues for Democrats to navigate, abortion rights. In some ways, the issue has been transformed from a Republican attack line to a Democratic advantage since the Supreme Court overturned a nationwide right in 2022. Schultz said Christian scripture does not make it clear precisely when human life begins and argued that Republicans oppose steps that would actually reduce abortions, better health care, access to contraceptives, and expanded child care. I think a person of faith sees these moral problems of the day and already has the lens and the framework with which to deal with it, said U.S. Rep. Morgan McGarvey, a Kentucky Democrat. Do we have food? Do we have health care? Do we have housing? Do we have an ICE agency which is even capable of respecting people's rights?